Hello and welcome to the NASBINI Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Grammy-nominated record producer and sound engineer, Ben Finlay. Now, Ben has worked at Peter Gabriel's Real World Studios, mixing live shows, radio broadcasts for the likes of Jeff Beck, Sting, Paul McCartney, and obviously Peter Gabriel himself. And currently you've been front of house desk for Paolo Nutini as well. But there's two projects in particular that we're really excited to talk to Ben about. And both of these projects have been part of NASBINI Magazine's review process. One of them being Thin Lizzy's Live and Dangerous Super Deluxe Edition, and also Jeff Beck's Bogan Apici Live in London and the box set that came out not that long ago. Either. So welcome, Ben, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Phil. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So before we get into the meat and spuds of the stuff, I'm really excited, and I know that many of my listeners and viewers will be as well. How did you start off in this career that's taken you to where you are now?
I think like many engineers, playing in bands, I love playing the guitar as a kid, and then you know, it was at the time when people like Jeff and Thin Lizzy and Peter Gabriel were at their kind of at the beginning of their apex, if you like. And I just found it very inspiring and wanted to be part of that. But then, you know, inevitably reality kicks in, and I didn't make it as a pop star and had to and couldn't bear not being involved. In fact, to this day, I still can't. You know, if I don't have any work, I find it really I just get really antsy, and I find myself just fiddling around with stuff trying to get involved. But so I lived on a farm in Somerset, so I moved to Pilton because that was the only sort of production that production area that I knew of and that was accessible, and started building stages at Worthy Farm and then for other festivals and things with a staging company, and then just didn't go away. And if anybody offered me an opportunity that was more in the direction that I was interested in, which was kind of technical, I would jump at those. And what I noticed was that when I said yes to stuff, you know, a number of doors behind that would open up. And when I said no to stuff, who knows how many thousand doors closed behind. Feel free to edit this, by the way, because I will go on. But when I was living in Pilton on the farm, there was a girl living there who was a caterer, and a friend of hers was doing he was looking after the lasers for the Rocky Horror Show at the Theatre Royal in Bath. And he needed a second man to help him focus the mirrors and what have you. And I'd never done anything like that before, but they said, yeah, go on, Ben, go, you know, Dave needs some help there. Go and give him a hand. So I went and did it, and we did the evening, and I really enjoyed it. Actually, it was brilliant and kind of stunning as well, because it was the Rocky Horror Show. I'd never seen anything like that before. And we, so at the end of the night, Dave goes, well, that was really good. You know, what are you doing the rest of the month? Do you want to come and do the rest of the tour with me? Wow. And this is how green I was, because part of my rent agreement to live on the farm was that I'd agreed to milk the cows for the guy whose farm it was. And I said, I'm really sorry, I can't, I've got to milk Steve's cows in the morning. So, and I've often thought actually that could have been a pivotal moment where it went from, I could have been doing lasers. Actually, yeah. I quite like to have done it. I was looking at some stuff on YouTube of The Prodigy, one of their live shows, and it's so visceral and alive. Yeah, I could have done that. Anyway, sorry, I digress. And then I guess the big opportunity I had was, I was lucky enough to tour with some local bands, and then I was working for a small audio company in Bristol, and the manager said, look, we've got this gig at Prior Park School, does anyone want to do it? Is the school play? And nobody was really interested in doing it. And I said, oh, I'll do it. It'll be fine, you know. And when I got there with a van load of PA, started setting the PA up, and a guy came up to me and he introduced himself as T. And he said that he was looking after the production for the school. And did I need any equipment? He'd hired some radios because they were mm-hmm. going to use radio mics, which was quite modern then. Anyway, it turned out that T was the studio manager at Real World. And at the end of the production run, which was a week, I said, oh, and, you know, I've really enjoyed working with you. And if, you know, if there's anything comes up at the studio, I'd be really interested. And genuinely didn't expect to hear anything. But then about a couple of weeks later, I had a phone call saying, oh, Van Morrison's coming in to do some rehearsals. Do you want to come and mix monitors for him? So I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And weirdly, I ended up getting on quite well with Van. And I was at the time I'd moved in with my then girlfriend, and she had a house, and Van phoned up one day and said, oh, do you fancy going for a cup of coffee down at the down at the Blue Note? And I'd employed somebody to show me how to use MIDI, because I'd started working at Real World by this time. Yeah. And I was a bit paranoid. I didn't really have a full grasp on it. So I'd got this guy in on my day off to bring his MIDI studio in, set it up, and show me how to work with it. And that was the same day that Van wanted to go out for a cup of coffee. So I said, I'd love to, Van, but I've got this guy around, and he's charging me a fortune. You can come around for a cup of tea. So Van, there's a knock at the door, and Van stood at the front door, and he came and sat in my front room, and we very awkwardly sipped a cup of tea together without an awful lot to say, to be honest, because we weren't in his, he liked going to the Blue Note, and I was thinking about MIDI. Yeah, anyway.
Amazing. So it is like it's one of those things, isn't it, in life, where those kind of like these strange coincidences, as you say, if you'd have said no to any of these things, then whole avenues of things would have closed down without you even knowing they existed.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And actually that has been the thing I've regretted most isn't the stuff I've done. It's the stuff I haven't done, you know, is those opportunities that, you know, that come your way and you can't do it. And it's heartbreaking, really, you know.
But we're looking at your resume and your website. You've obviously managed to say yes to a lot of other things.
I have, yes.
You've got some really, really impressive stuff. But one of the ones I want to land on now is that one of the most legendary live double albums of all time was by Thin Lizzy, Live and Dangerous, and which was, you know, a band that crossed over from rock to pop to whatever they were on Top of the Pops, just as much as they were in the kind of rock charts, etc.
Yeah,
and
amazing.
The album has taken on its own mystique. And with over the years, you know, as we went through the vinyl to CD era, these stories about, you know, Tony Visconti and sometimes everything was redone in the studio. Everybody wanted to redo their bits once they realized Phil Lynott wanted to do his bits. And Scott Gorham would say, oh, no, we didn't. And Tony would say, oh, yes, you did. And it's and luckily through the world of technology and the fact that we now are able to have super deluxe editions of these classic albums, the super deluxe edition of Live and Dangerous came out with all the source concerts for the original double live album appeared at the start of this year. I think it sold out within 24 hours. Well, it's been
depressed
now. Yeah, it went.
Oh,
it
wow.
Literally disappeared that fast. It was gone as soon as Amazon said, here it is. There it wasn't. But I think a lot of fans realized when they started to listen to the source concerts.
Yeah.
That you're probably expecting it to be nowhere near or a pale shadow of the original album, just how live and dangerous the band really were. But you have actually, you were there in amongst the multi-tracks. So what did you find?
Well, my initial involvement was in 2003 when my friend took delivery of a pallet of multitracks, and he asked me to transfer them to digital.
Yeah.
So there was a digital archive. So that was the first time I came across them. And then the idea to make the box set sort of coalesced around 2019, around that sort of time.
Yeah.
And so once I started opening up the sessions and going through and getting rid of stuff, because although they were all recorded onto 24 track 2-inch originally. Yeah. So all of the sessions had the 24 channels in them. And some of them didn't have anything on them. So you clear those out because you don't need to listen to those. And but then as I went through it, I realized that there were on some tracks, there were like little overdub patches where it was apparent that there'd been some overdubs. There wasn't really a brief for the Live and Dangerous 8-box CD. The approach I took to mixing it was that we have Live and Dangerous. That was done by Tony and the guys, and it's an amazing document of the sort of aspiration they had for the sound of the concerts and what have you. And it was, I have to say, you know, like the mixes that I did didn't come out of thin air. I was referencing the original Live and Dangerous CD the whole time so that it made sense for the listener that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't like a 1980s mix with big reverbs or, you know, like that. I tried to maintain the kind of spirit of what they'd done at the time. But the other thing I did try and do was, because these CDs were coming out as individual shows, I thought it would be interesting to try and keep the original parts from the shows as much as possible. So on, for example, on Baby Drives Me Crazy from the Live and Dangerous version, there's a solo that Scott takes where there's a little fingering mismanagement happens. And in those days, what you had to do was replace the guitar solo. So on that occasion, that's what they did. But for the box set, the nature of the, basically his hand slipped in on the position of the neck.
Yeah.
And he just played the phrase that he was trying to play, a semitone down from where it was. So you can fix that nowadays because the guitar is on its own. You can just take those four notes that were out of whack and just put them back where they meant to be. And suddenly you've got the original intention there. So that is an example of what I did with Baby Drives Me Crazy. So if you listen to the solo on the Live and Dangerous box set, the Hammersmith show from the 16th, Baby Drives Me Crazy, the solo is different on that one from the Live and Dangerous album, even though it's the same performance, because on the album they use the overdub, and on the box set, we used a slightly adjusted one. And the other thing was, particularly with that song, I suppose it's a good example. On the Live and Dangerous album, Tony and the guys did quite a lot, four edits on that song to just tighten the pace of it up so that it gets, so that it sort of moves through quicker, because obviously there's a lot of call and response in that song with the audience that Phil would do. So, and there's repeated sections of that call and response. So he was just having fun on the night. But for a record, you don't necessarily want to go through that that full length. And there was also the other thing they would have had half an eye on is that You can only really get 20 minutes on a side of vinyl.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and so they would have been thinking about, well, you know, if we lose, what have we got here? I've got it here. So that's 20, 40. Yeah, so there's nearly 3 minutes of audio edited out of this version. So that's a quick song. That, you know, that could be. So, so they'd have had half an eye on that as well, I think, which is why that happened. But I can do it. Is now a good time to show it?
Now's the time to dive in, I think. Yeah.
So I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
So in this session, we've got, so if I zoom out, this is reel three from the 16th of February 1976. And if I give a quick burst, you can hear there's one song.
Yeah.
And we get to Sha-la-la-la. And then, so this is Baby Drives Me Crazy, and this was included on the Live and Dangerous album. So what you see here is the Live and Dangerous version that appeared on the album. And these spaces here is what Tony and the guys took out from the original version. So if I just play a quick sniff of baby. 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 So
those are the bits that were taken out.
Yeah. That's the original crossover. Yeah. And what happened on the Live and Dangerous version in the same place was baby. Baby. Oh, that helps if I open up the right channels, doesn't it? Sorry about that. So you can see that on the Live and Dangerous thing, and I can demonstrate how they would. So this area here that's just lit up would represent the tape that was left on the cutting room floor, as it were. Wow. So if I now take that out, and what follows up just joins up. That's just the drum kit in solo.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can see that there was quite a lot of editing went on in order to make that the version.
How much harder in those days was it to do edits like that compared with where you are now? With what way, as you know, on a current, you know, when you're recording almost every gig when you go on a modern concert tour.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like that. Demonstration edit I did was on the multi-track, which of course is something you'd have been very reticent to do because there were no copies. There was no undo button. You know, if you cut a chunk out of the multi-track, if they'd have decided to do that, we would never have been able to look at this whole thing. So what they would have done is they'd have recorded the mix in its entirety, and then they'd have cut out the sections that occupied this space here.
Yeah.
So these bits would have been two track quarter inch tape or half inch tape, probably quarter inch. that would have been tape that would have been thrown away in order to make the whole thing.
Wow.
One complete thing.
And as you went through the concert, the norm, or was that like an anomaly because it was a song which had lots of audience interaction? So there were obviously bits were taken out because it was a live track. But were there this kind of idea that lots of bits were redone and retweaked? What did you find overall?
over the whole of the album?
Yeah.
Actually, I'd say there was not that much editing. This is because of where this song falls in the set, and it's a call and answer thing. So you know, they were having fun at this point in the set, really. Yeah. And, so the, that's why this one, I think, was so, it was edited so hard. There's a couple of edits here and there, but overall, not that much. And it's the same with the overdubs. In fact, I think I can safely, I'm pretty sure that there were no overdubs at all on by Brian Downey or Brian Robertson. So other than, I think Brian joined in on some backing vocals where they were, you know, like where they were doing backing vocal overdubs. But in terms of their key parts, there were no overdubs. So what you hear on Live and Dangerous is what they played on the night. Fantastic. Which is pretty spectacular, really. I mean,
so how many tracks was it recorded on overall for the original multi tracks? How many channels?
Yeah, it was 24.
24.
So it was 24 channels running at 15 IPS for the UK shows, and then when you got to the United States and Canada, they were running at 30 IPS.
Yeah.
So it makes a difference, because a 15 IPS reel or a reel of a 10-inch spool running at 15 IPS gives you half an hour of audio. And 30 gives you 15. But what they did in the United States, I think these were recorded using the Rolling Stones mobile, and they only had one 24-track machine in there. So as they were getting towards the end of the reel of tape, they would, I'm not sure if they would signal to the stage that they were swapping the reels over, but they would have to do kind of crash, like spool off the reel and then stick the new one on, thread it.
Wow.
And slam it into record and hope they didn't miss any of the front end of anything, which there were a couple. I mean, they weren't songs that were used on the album, so it didn't matter, but there were a couple of points in the show where there were starts, like you'd miss the count or, you know. And there were also, we had some issues with, which I think on the liner notes for the box set, on the second night at Hammersmith, the second half of the show, I think four, maybe five tunes came from that night. But the first half of the show, they had a real issue with the tape machine in the Rolling Stones mobile, where the pinch roller wasn't hitting the capstan hard enough to keep the tape coming, pulling the tape through across the record head. And you were getting this initially, what it started off as a kind of wow, like a speeding up and slowing down as the pinch roller started to lose traction on the back of the tape. And then eventually it just got so bad that there wasn't anything we could do about it. So that's why we ended up losing, I think, on the second CD on the box set there, the set is significantly reduced, because I think we lost two songs because of the wow and flutter. Mm. In fact, the back end of the I think they got three songs into it, and then the fourth, three songs into it, and at the end of the third song, you can just hear it starting to go. If you listen to the CD carefully, you can just hear it's all like a bit, and then the next song was gone, and the song after that, and then they changed the reel, and when they changed the reel, because they wouldn't have been aware of that at the time.
No, of course
they
weren't.
So it was only when it was playing back that would have been apparent. Then the next reel comes on, and the pinch roller slams up against the capstan good and firm. So there's no wow and flutter. But it was, I think the next song was,
I've got the box here.
It's the slow one.
Oh, Still in Love With You.
Yeah, Still in Love With You. So that, I think that one, the guitars were just so, they were out of tune. I don't know what happened on stage, but there was something. So I think we lost that one as well. So, but I mean, those, those were the hazards of working at that time. I mean, it's still, recording live shows is incredibly difficult. You'd, you know, especially if you're a mobile truck and you're just turning up at a gig that is already established. You know, when you're on tour, night after night, you're doing the same thing, plugging the same thing into the same hole, and it, and sometimes you might get a fault or, you know, jiggly connection or something, but basically everybody knows what they're doing. Then when you have someone turn up who's trying to record the show, first of all, they're working off a channel list. So they, it's a theoretical channel list. Sometimes things change or, you know, stuff goes wrong in the mobile or things get plugged in the wrong way. So there's, it's getting everything working at the moment when everything needs to can be sometimes a bit hairy.
I guess the other thing, of course, is that you have to take yourself back to that time, and the musicians themselves have thought, oh, we're going to record a live album. It's going to be recorded over several tracks, so that one doesn't quite work, or that one sounds better than the night before.
Yeah.
Nobody back then, including Tony Visconti, when they pulled it all together, would have thought that decades later, somebody would have been interested in all the Source concerts. And someone will actually get dissected and take the lid off and actually look at all of these things and re-release it. That wouldn't have been in anyone's imagination, would it?
No, it's extraordinary. And that, well, yes, because I think they, at the time, like, first of all, for the guys in the band, a show was a daily occurrence. It was just like another show. Yeah. So, and of course, it would have had some importance because they were trying to, they were putting together a live album. So of course they would have been aware of that, but nobody would have known at the time how important that album would become in the kind of, in their canon, in the Thin Lizzy canon, but also in the, in like, as a record in its own right, in the whole ecology of music at the time. You know, it's a corner piece record in a way.
Well, it is, because what was it, 1978? You go back 10 years, which is 1968, and rock was only just forming, and nobody back then thought further ahead than probably 2 or 3 years.
No.
So it's just a stopgap before the next studio album. They wouldn't have thought that, you know, guys, people are going to look back, and when they do list of the top live albums of all time, this is going to be in the top three, if not at the top position. It wouldn't have crossed their minds that it was that, it would have that kind of, you know, status, really.
No, 1968, Ringo was still eyeing up barber shops with a view to retiring. that was how people thought about it in those
days. Exactly. So in a way, we have to look back and think that the way this was recorded was amazing. That the tapes, you know, because there's lots of things that were recorded after this date that haven't survived so well. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we did have to, in order to make the initial transfer from analog to digital, so this is back in 2003 when we did it, we had to bake the tapes because Ampex particularly were affected by this, but they're basically all old tapes. Once they get past a certain age, if they're sat on a shelf, they absorb moisture from the atmosphere, and the kind of cellulose that holds all of the oxide onto the backing of the tape absorbs moisture, and it becomes kind of a bit sticky and gooey. And if you try and play that tape, the tension of the tape being pulled across the tape head causes the cellulose to kind of rub off on the tape head, and then it basically the
gone.
It well, first of all, yes, you've got your material stuck on the tape head, which is not great, and the machine just lets go and won't play it. So the way you get around it is you put it in a laboratory oven for six. Well, there are debates about this, like many things. But when we did it, I think we had it had the tape sitting at between 60 and 62 degrees centigrade for 3 days.
Wow.
And they just sit, you know, it's like the warming tray of an Arga, that sort of temperature. And I have actually heard of people doing that.
I mean, was this just very fascinated by the fact that how did someone find out that that was the right temperature and that was the right amount of time? Was that trial and error? You know,
I think so. I don't know, yeah. But I would. It's the kind of thing that you would come to quickly because, first of all, you know that you don't want to go much more than, I wouldn't want to take it much more than 65, 66, because then you start to get into kind of oxidized, like the heat causing interaction with the oxygen in the atmosphere. Mm. And the beginnings of being on fire. So you don't want that.
No.
But at the same time, you need to chase the water, get it as close to 100 degrees or so that the moisture, the water content in the cellulose is evaporates out. So, yeah, I mean, I think an educated guess would put it at around that temperature.
So, because I know they did that with things like Deep Purple's Made in Japan, where they baked all the tapes tickets before they could reissue it. So once that's done, that process is finished, are the tapes just retired for good? That's it?
They can. So basically they're good to play for, at archive standard, anything up to 2 weeks. But I have known reels of tape go on for a lot longer. I've got some quarter-inch tape, which I got given that was still in its box, but it was 25 years old. Mm-hmm. So I baked that, and I used it for 3 years, you know, just as I'd put mixes onto the tape and then bring it back into Pro Tools before you had tape saturation plugins as a way of acquiring tape saturation for my mixes in Pro Tools. And that worked for years and years and years afterwards. So the orthodoxy is that once you've baked it, you make the transfer as soon as you can after it's cooled down, and then you retire it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can do it again. You know, it's not that you can't ever do that again. It's just better to get it right first time and hang on to not lose a digital copy.
But I suppose once you've got them into the digital domain, that it's safe and it is. It's just all the tweaks are done afterwards. Are they safe?
No, they're not. Analog is a much more robust medium for long-term storage.
Really?
It's digital is a bit of a nightmare, really. Like, I've done projects where we were working in Pro Tools in 1998, 1999, and you generate maybe 20, 30 gigabytes of material for a session. And then back in those days, it would only be at 48 kilohertz, 24 bit, but so it wasn't like today where you've got 96 or 192 kilohertz where you generate terabytes of stuff without even thinking about it. But in those days, like a session, you'd be like up around 40, 50 gigabytes to store. So, but there weren't hard drives to do that. So we used to use these, I think initially it was DDS1 and then it went to 2, 3, and 4, and then AIT was the subsequent backup tape medium. But all of these tapes were dependent on tape management software that ran in, we were using Mac, so it was running an OS 9, which I don't know anyone who has a computer that Mac that runs OS 9 anymore. And so even if you have the tape with the backup on it, first of all, you've got to find the right playback machine and a computer that's running the right has the right operating system that will run the management software that was used to back it up. So although it may still be present on the tape, actually accessing the data is very hard. And to all intents and purposes, those projects are gone unless you take it to... There are some companies who specialize in archive recovery and things. But then that's not cheap.
That's also very interesting. So would that be that, because obviously going back in more recent time with digital technologies, that you would save things to the highest bit rate and the highest format as you had it then. But of course, what you're suggesting is that things have moved on decades later, and what was seen as the highest quality digital export file then actually isn't that good now.
No. So when we archived this, the Thin Lizzy stuff, all these multi-tracks, we did it at what was then quite a high resolution. It was 96 kilohertz, 24 bit. But I think now the archive standard is 192. It changes.
So a question that's just occurred to me, because obviously as a music collector, and of which most, if not all, of my listeners and viewers are, we constantly end up, no one thought we'd ever be doing this, is buying the same album multiple times because it's been remastered using the latest whatever bit technology.
Yeah.
And sometimes some of us will cynically think, oh, well, I bought the last remaster. Do I really need another one? But is there literally then some food for thought in that the technology is moving along, that potentially it is better than the previous one?
Well, mastering. So first of all, there's a couple of, I've noticed in conversations about, you know, reissues of things. I did this.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know.
I mixed that, and on a couple of reviews of that, I noticed that the reviewers talked about it being remastered, that the audio was remastered, which it wasn't. It was remixed, and there's a big difference. So the when you remix something, you go back to the multitrack and you start at the very beginning and you push up the first fader and you go, that's how loud I want my bass drum and that's how loud I want my snare drum and this is how loud I want all the different components. And then the mastering happens at the end of that process.
Yeah.
So if you buy something that's been remastered, normally what will have happened is the record label will have gone back to their archive and they'll have found the stereo quarter inch version of the product that they're remastering. And they'll take it to a mastering engineer and they'll go, here you go, Tony, tweak that, make it sound a bit more 2022, you know, a bit less 2017 or whenever the previous one was. and honestly, the remastering thing is, it's a way of adding value. I think it allows other people to bring, like mastering engineers are like magicians, or, you know, there's a sort of voodoo that happens with those guys. And they can take stuff that you thought was actually, you know, you thought, oh, well, that sounds pretty good. And you give it to them and they'll find the nuances in the tonal shape of what you've delivered, and give it cohesion. I think that's the main thing that I notice, is you hand in a bunch of mixes that are all done at different times, but by, you know, over a month or a 2 month period or however long the production period was. And they kind of just make it sound like a whole thing. But that's a different thing from remixing something, where you're going back to the multitrack and starting again.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for that, Ben. The other one that I reviewed was obviously BBA, Jeff Beck's Beck Bogart and Apici Live album. What I think the amazing part of that box set was obviously the unreleased London gig.
Yeah.
Because no one even really knew that existed. And that sounds absolutely stunning. What, I mean, unfortunately, Jeff Beck sadly passed away soon after that. Was he actually involved in that bit together? Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, my involvement with Jeff came about because I initially mixed his live shows from 2009. And then as often happens, like our schedules, like he would stop touring and then I'd find somebody else to work with, and then their schedules would overlap, so I couldn't work with him. So I think the last tour I did with him was in about 2016, 2017. But in that time, we got to know each other quite well, and he would call me up and say, oh, Ben, I've got these artists would invite Jeff to overdub solos and guitar parts on their records.
I like Ozzy Osbourne.
Exactly, like that. So Jeff would phone up and say, I've got three of these things that need doing. I'll get them to send you the link to the stems. So I download the stems, put them on my laptop, and take a little portable system up to Jeff's house, and then we get there and sit and drink wine and just generally socialize, and then the next day we'd spend the day overdubbing on these various projects.
Sorry to interrupt. And was that then literally, you said you took your laptop up, was it literally you'd record onto your laptop with Jeff just doing his solo? You just capture
that? I take a nice interface and some nice mics bits and pieces. But basically, yeah, I mean, because studios now, they inhabit such a tiny space. I'm talking to you now in my home studio, and everything runs off a Mac Mini. And I mixed that Thin Lizzy box set. I mixed that with it, and I mean it's a bit more elaborate because there's loads of screens and stuff, so you can take in lots of information at the same time. But essentially, it's just off a Mac Mini. I was there one day with him, and he said, let's go up the barn and see what we've got in there. Yeah, I've got a load of tapes. I'm sure there's something up there we could do something with. Yeah. So we went up to his barn and had to squeeze past some of his cars because there wasn't enough room in the garage for the cars. And made our way up to the barn, and we were just rummaging through these piles of multitrack that would, and we found the Beck Bogart and A-Piece tapes, and then did the same thing, basically baked them and then took them to a studio and got them transferred off 24 track into digital.
They were 24 track as well even back then, because that'd be what, 74 was it?
Yes, they were. I know they were on 2-inch. And now you say that, I think they might have been 16 channel. Yeah. So they'd have been 1/4-inch per track. Yeah, I think you're right, because we had to rent a 16 track head block to put on a modern 24 track machine to do it. So thank you for that. but this, I mean, you can see, like, you know, it's interesting. In fact, on that box set in the liner notes, there's mention, which I think you picked up on actually, that there was some overdubs that Jeff did on that record. Which he never did. On the London show, he never did any overdubs. I don't know how it's ended up on that, but going through it on the multi-track, because when I saw that, I was like, really? I don't remember that. And so I opened up the multi and had a look, and there aren't any overdubs, unless he'd punched in on the original track, which you would never do, you know, because in those days, you hung on to the original one because you didn't want to damage it. You always went on a spare channel. So, and there was no, like on the Thin Lizzy tracks, you can see where there are overdubs in there, and there's nothing like that on the BBA. So quite where that came from, I don't know. It might have been, because sometimes Jeff would talk to people or do interviews with people, and he might have mentioned it.
So in a way, we were very lucky, because I imagine Live in Dangerous, the multi-tracks are being looked after probably a lot better than Live in London in Jeff Beck's barn, where it didn't even have an official release. So it's almost as if no one was really interested or ever thought that would come out. So was there any, did you have to do any maintenance to get that into, apart from baking the tapes? Was it a harder project to work on?
Not really. Those particular tapes, I mean, it does vary. They had been in storage at somebody's farm in the southwest before Jeff had got them back. And those particular ones for that show, they weren't in too bad shape. But there were some, you know, when you started to unspool the tape, the cellulose had on, you know, the magnetic side of it had bound to the back of the next layer of tape, so that we couldn't use that. We had to get that sonically cleaned, which I'm not entirely sure how that works, but I think they dunk it in a liquid and then it breaks down the...
I think it's very interesting to know that it was Jeff's kind of inspiration that got that off the ground, because I think the feeling was through the world of music was that he went off the idea of a power trio as he started to move towards his jazz fusion period. So I think one of the great things about listening to that, especially the London gig, is you could actually see the steps he was taking within that concert, whereas the one from the year before was more of a traditional power trio in a way.
But
in the 74 concert, you could tell he was moving on, by the fact the amount of new songs that would have been on the second album are featured, aren't they?
Yes, and he did. He said that there were some. He was trying to find those tapes actually when we were up in his barn. We never actually found them, but he said somewhere there are some early versions of stuff that he was doing with those guys, because I think they went into the studio for a couple of sessions. I didn't find those, but I'm in contact with Jeff's manager, and we have been talking about finding a way of going through that stuff. Part of the problem is I'm in Scotland now, so it's not. I used to live in the southwest, so it was relatively easy for me to run over to where Jeff was and do stuff without it costing an awful lot of money. But nowadays, it's a bit of a project.
Yes, I imagine it is. Though, I mean, you've worked on so many different projects in your career so far. What are the most memorable ones? If you had to pick some moments that come out and think, "Yeah, that was a really, really good one."
I have to say that working for Peter Gabriel was probably there. That was my first. Sort of being dunked into the world of stardom. And it was very exciting working for him because he's very, he's really demanding about
sound
and the way stuff is done and not accepting, option A. He's always interested in option A, B, C, D, and keep going. So you have to think in terms of, actually, I mentioned earlier about never saying no to work. He takes that don't say no thing into his work. So, he's always keen to explore new ideas and other ways of doing things. So that was quite exciting. And to be fair to Peter, I think none of the really great projects that I've got to do subsequently would have come about had he not asked me to do it.
I suppose it's the reputation of I remember seeing a documentary in the 70s. I think it was around the Peter Gabriel 3 or 4 album when there was they were filming him going around like a scrapyard hitting pipes to get different sounds and sampling them. And he's thought, wow, this guy's really, really into capturing things that no one else can.
That's right. And the sound of him, it's the Melvin Bragg, bum bum ba da da dum bum ba program. I can't remember what it's called, but there's a piece where he breaks the TV screen, or it has a couple of goes at it, and then that sample ended up in the Fairlight and was used a lot, and it even turned up. I remember, there were sounds that he created at that time using the Fairlight that made it. All the way, the last tour I did with Peter was in 2013, and we were still digging out Fairlight samples that had been created back in those days to augment stuff, because that machine had a real sound of its own. It was the first generation sampler, and they did an amazing job of taking a, I think it was an 8-bit 24 kilohertz sample rate. So it was very low res, but the way the A to D and D to A converters managed that was just made it sound fantastic.
Amazing. So just thinking now, as you know, because so much before we went live, you were talking to Paolo Nutini about you've been obviously you've just been out on tour with him and you record all the gigs, thinking about to Live and Dangerous and Jeff Beck. Recording a live album back then was getting the mobile studio outside and everybody coming in to record it. Now, yeah. We're at a stage where literally, just for reference perhaps, you almost record every gig. So yeah. Almost any gig could become a live album, should it need to be. Is that how, from your perspective, is it so much easier now to capture a band live for a live concert?
Yeah, it's... Compared to what it was, it's effortless, really, because as you know, so I was mixing Paolo's live shows over the last couple of years, and I have built into the racks all the interfaces that just, you know, you plug up at the beginning of the day, as you're plugging it in, all that stuff gets plugged in without really thinking about it. The only thing I have to think about is making sure I put have a session to record it into, and I remember to put the ambient mics out, because obviously a live show isn't much fun unless you record the audience. So we have two for Paolo shows, we have two shotgun mics on the stage that point into the audience, and then I have another stereo mic at front of house to get the back audience. But those. And I don't, to be honest, I don't even do the ambient mics at the front. The stage crew do that. So it really is, compared to what they would have had to have gone through for Live and Dangerous, it's a very different beast.
And totally different to in years to come, when people think, oh, we found another archive concert from whatever year. This will be so different to today's artists, where there'll be literally libraries full of potential tours, weren't there?
Yeah.
I mean, is everything kept and backed up and stored away?
I can show you. So this is the... So when I'm recording, I record on directly to a solid state drive, which is...
Tiny.
It's tiny. It's connected to that. It's that. So that's a 3 terabyte solid state drive, but then I back it up onto this, which is just it's two. These are two taped together. So at the end, at the beginning of the day. So I suppose this is a bit of effort that I go to when I'm recording a live show. So at the beginning of the day, I'll take the solid state drive that has the previous night's show on, and I copy it onto two.
Those
rotary drives. So that, I think they're 8 terabyte each. And so that all of last year's shows I did with Paolo are on those, which on the one hand is quite, and these are mirror image of one another as well. And it's not so that if one drive dies, in theory, you've got
the other one. And they're all, it's the entire multi-tracks. It's everything.
Yes. Yeah. So, and Paolo's, I mean, like, the Thin Lizzy stuff is 24 channels.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, it was less than that, because I think there's 5 spare channels, and they, yeah. So it's like 19 channels of actual music and audience. Mm-hmm. And Paolo's, what comes off the stage, I think I'm getting 64 channels off the stage.
And what's, and how big's Paolo's band?
7 of them in the band.
7 of them, but
yeah. Yeah, because yeah, you've got like, and sometimes they'll, wow. And you have to have one channel for something that might only go off once. Like then, at the beginning of the set, he picks up a phone
it has its own channel.
And it has its own channel, but it only gets used for like half of the song. And
yeah. But it means you've got complete control should you ever have to want to use any of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just sort of reassemble it. You know, when you're mixing it, you kind of take out And also, so I, just for the crack, as much as anything, I record the comms between me, myself, and the monitor engineer. So we can, I can hear what I said during the show to the monitor engineer, or I can play back to her whatever she said.
Absolutely incredible.
And some of the crew as well, because all the comms that the show has are all wired.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think that the future of sound engineering is? Do you think it's? Do you think it's still changing as rapidly as it was since the kind of onset of digital technology, or do you think it's kind of leveling off a bit?
I think the thing about particularly live engineering, but to a certain extent, studio engineering as well. You know, you're managing random space. And you're managing a number of random elements. You're the band, who never play the same thing twice, unless it's on Pro Tools. But a band like Paolo's, there isn't a computer on stage. There's a little drum machine, but that's as close to as a computer they have. So every night, it all shifts and moves and is a different. It's an actual different event. So you've got that area of randomness, and then every venue you play in sounds different. You know, the acoustic space that you're operating in is different. So it's like if you go to the Colston Hall, it sounds like one thing. And then if you go to, you know, another gig, I can't think of one off the top of my head, sound very different.
So can I just another question that's just bubbled up to the surface about Thin Lizzy in that case, because obviously we're going back to the 70s where the technology wasn't around as you have now. The original album, those tracks were recorded in different venues.
Yeah.
How did they go about trying to bring in the ambience so it sounds like one continuous gig? Was it easy for you to see there was differences when you were remixing?
You can hear them. You can hear the different sounding rooms in the audience mics, but it's less apparent on the close mics.
Right.
And I know that one of the things that Tony was rightly praised for was the use of the audience on Live and Dangerous. It was, I think he went to a lot of trouble to make it feel like a live album as much as possible. And it's relatively easy nowadays. You can just kind of pick up 8 channels of audience and just slide them around and nick them from one show and drop them into another one. But to do it back then, you had to, you basically had to copy the audience onto a reel of tape and then play that reel of tape
over the other gig.
And mix them so that it made some kind of sense. That was originally recorded on 16 channels and then transferred to 24. And somebody at some point had tried to do what Tony Visconti did and generate an audience track, because there was one ambient mic for the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it basically sounded like it was just hanging over the front of the audience barrier. You know, there were like 3 girls on it going mad, and you weren't really aware of the other 20,000 people that were kind of
sitting behind.
Yeah. So when I mixed that, I did cheat a little bit, and I've in the village where I live, I arranged, I got a budget from the record label of £200, and I bought a load of beer, and a friend of mine has a building where we could all gather, and a little PA system and a TV screen, and I took my computer and some microphones. Gave everybody the beer and said, okay, we're going to play you the tape. And then when Phil sings, you got to do the call and response thing. And so we did about 4 takes of that. And then I took that recording. It was for Baby Drives Me Crazy, because we kind of got away with everything else using found bits of audience. The Baby Drives Me Crazy thing was very specific. So,
of course, yeah.
So, but anyway, so I got the, Kirkmichael village to sing along with the with the show, recorded it, and then put it back in the show.
Fantastic.
And yeah, and it, I mean, it's not, you know, if you balance it with the one microphone that was there,
yeah,
it kind of, it sort of made some sense. But also part of the problem was it was a 5.1 mix, so couldn't really get the sort of depth of without having some stereo mics, or at least more than one feed. Anyway, it's cheating, I know, but nobody's noticed yet.
No, until now. No.
I expect I'll get hate mail.
I wouldn't have thought so. Was there any thought finally that Live Endangered could be a 5.1 mix?
There was no discussion about it at all from the record label point of view, but the Rainbow Show also exists on
Is that the DVD, is it?
Yeah so it's that.
Yes, that one.
That, and so I knew that existed, so when I did the mix of the material for the Rainbow Show, I basically did 5.1 versions as well. So who knows if the record label decide it's a good idea, or if, you know, then I'd cheerfully do it.
Excellent. Excellent. You never know, do you? You never know.
No. It's low hanging fruit. You know, the product's there. It sounds a bit ropey at the moment, in all honesty.
Yeah.
And it would be relatively straightforward to make it sound.
Yeah, and totally. And I'll say one of the top inquiries I've had about this whole thing was, Phil, why didn't they include the DVD? And I always thought, well, they must be. They're probably holding that back for a rainy day. So they've got something else to put out there.
Nobody mentioned it.
Interesting. So finally, Ben, what are you working on in 2024?
Well, actually, nothing. As things stand, I haven't got anything to do, but I'm sure something will come
up. I'm sure something is going to come up. Yeah.
It usually does. And actually, Paola was just on the phone, so I think we might be doing... We're looking at
a live box set.
I hope not.
Volume one.
No. I don't know. I think he just wants to get a sense of what we've actually got.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Which is a lot. Well,
which is a lot. Yeah.
So if you want to find out more about Ben, go to benfinlay.com. And we can see all your different projects on there. And thank you so much, Ben, for all your time this afternoon. It's been absolutely fascinating and really exciting to talk about all these projects.
No, really, I love the channel. Really like your channel. So,
Thank you very much. A huge thank you to my guest, Ben Finlay. And what a fantastic conversation that was. So now we know just what was involved in mixing Thin Lizzy's Live and Dangerous, and the stories about Jeff Beck, Peter Gabriel. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Also, it was really good to hear about remasters and remixing and the differences and how all of this comes about, and the changing technology that does make you wonder whether actually it probably is worth buying the latest remaster compared with the one that was 15 years ago. But that was a fantastic conversation. And, you know, Thin Lizzy's Live and Dangerous box set is one of the best box sets of 2023. So to hear what was involved and to see all those tracks and how some of those songs and how some of the overdubs were done and the challenges they had at recording that album as well back in the day compared with recording concerts now. Absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much indeed again to Ben. Check out his website if you want to have more of his projects. The link will appear at the end of this video and podcast. And thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for subscribing to the podcast, the website, and the YouTube channel. Become a patron. Support me via Ko-fi. But remember, music is the healer and the doctor. So stay safe, keep spinning those discs, and I shall see you on my next episode.